We've got a lot of good legislation done as far as bills go, but that budget itself overall was an outstanding bill.
Kentucky Republican leaders are choosing to leave Kentucky's families and Kentucky's children behind.
Kentucky wrapped up its 2024 legislative session earlier this month, but Democrats and Republicans don't see eye to eye about the budget they passed. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our regional politics show, we're going to focus on Kentucky and discuss what passed and failed in the General Assembly and the battle brewing over school choice this fall. Joining me now are Eastern Kentucky University government professor Ann Sismar. Thanks for being here, Ann.
Thank you.
University of Kentucky Associate Professor of Political Science, Stephen Voss. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
And Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter, Sylvia Goodman. Thanks for being here, Sylvia.
Glad to be here.
Let's start off with what was accomplished and what wasn't during this session.
We have gone from border to border, be it east or west, north or south, and invested in every region in the state substantially.
That was Republican Senate President Robert Stivers talking about the budget, but Democratic State Senator Casey Chambers Armstrong said on KET that more could have been accomplished.
What concerns me when we look at the session overall are those missed opportunities and the way, yes, we did some really good things, like the Momnibus, like investing in rural health care. We also spent a lot of time focusing on the issues that divide us instead of putting our time and attention on those efforts that unite us as Kentuckians and deliver results for the people of the Commonwealth. So I think about things like we cut the sales tax on gold bars, but we didn't cut the sales tax on diapers. We failed to give our teachers a raise, even though we all like to talk about how important education is in our Commonwealth. We passed this massive crime bill that's going to cost $1 billion, at least $1 billion for our state over the next 10 years. And yet we didn't do anything to address a single root cause of crime.
And what are your general impressions of what was accomplished and what wasn't this legislative session?
I usually think the truth is somewhere in the middle on politics. And so I definitely think Republicans are right about some of those good bills that passed, including things like Momnibus, which had pretty widespread support, despite some last minute kind of challenges to some of the language that might have been included in there. At the same time, however, you do see politicians are representing their constituents and the voters back home. And so you also saw some divisive bills like anti-DEI or things which maybe are favorable in terms of a legislative strategy, thinking about the elections.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about all of those in more detail as we continue this conversation. Stephen, what are your thoughts? Anything you want to add to what Ann just said about kind of what got done and what didn't this past session?
I agree with Ann that the glass is sort of half full, half empty, depending on what party you are. I guess what I'd emphasize is that for a legislature that's so overwhelmingly Republican and that could basically steamroll a Democratic governor, it's remarkable how what the Republicans did does sort of fall between a sort of extreme conservative sort of budget and what the Democrats would have liked. It's a fairly moderate budget for how Republican Kentucky has become. Hmm.
Sylvia, let's talk about the Safer Kentucky Act. That was this major anti-crime bill that we've talked about before on the show. Explain some of what this law will do and when it will take effect.
Sure. It really is a massive bill. That's why I've been talking about it so much and looking into it so heavily. It's aimed at tamping down especially violent crime. It includes a three strikes law for violent felony offenders. It raises penalties on a number of crimes, one of those being fleeing the police. It raises the penalties on that. It also makes more crimes violent in Kentucky. Attempted violent crimes didn't previously count as violent, and now they will when this bill goes into effect. That effectively lowers parole eligibility. I would also note that it does quite a few nonviolent things. So it increases penalties on several nonviolent crimes. So, for example, it fines parents for not showing up to court for their child's court hearings. It implements this street camping ban, which is quite controversial both here in Kentucky and across the country. We can talk about that more later. But, for example, there's this Supreme Court case that deals with it in Oregon. It also allows the use of force to detain suspected shoplifters. It does a lot of things in conclusion, and it's set to go into effect in mid-July.
And Sylvia, what were the big arguments for and against this bill? I know, like you said, it covers a whole lot of ground. What do those big arguments come down to?
So essentially, the argument in favor of the bill is that we need to do something to address violent crime in the state. There was a really large spike during the pandemic, kind of 2021 area, and especially in murders. And in Louisville, the murders spiked substantially in 2021. And so there's this idea that we need to do more to punish criminals who commit these crimes, that we need to do more to keep them locked up for longer so that they can't be in society committing more crimes. The argument against that bill, we heard one from Senator Cassie Chambers Armstrong, who's from Louisville, earlier, that it's really expensive and there's not more money currently allocated for corrections to deal with the potential huge influx into the prison population. A lot of prisons and jails are already overcrowded in Kentucky, so it's unclear how we're supposed to deal with that. There's also some concerns about the data behind the Safer Kentucky Act. I reported on that extensively. So we were given, press and live on the floor. We were given this list of sources that don't seem to really necessarily back up a lot of the things in the bill. And so there's questions of whether or not it will actually be effective in reducing crime. So there's a lot of different arguments for and against it. I will note again, back to that street camping ban, that's really been the most controversial, I would say, the one that's gotten the most attention. Governor Andy Beshear, when he issued his veto, said that that was one of the primary reasons he felt he couldn't sign the bill, is that he had to stand against it on moral grounds because of that ban, that it would hurt homeless people more than anyone else.
Republican State Representative Michael Sarge Pollock was asked on KET about what the data shows about homelessness and crime.
So the homelessness and that whole part of that is not necessarily attacking them for crime. The homeless part of that is looking to say, how can we help you? And now, whether it's provide that shelter, provide the sources that you need, whether it's addiction, whether it's food, whatever it is. But the part of that part is that homelessness was basically in front of stores, in front of people's livelihood. And so what we were trying to say is, look, I know there's an issue. We all know there's an issue. Let's find a way to kind of keep them out of the streets in some other places of shelter, whatever that looks like. And that's something that we've got to take a hard look at. But that was the intent, in my opinion, of what House Bill 5 was about.
Stephen, what does that debate over House Bill 5, the fact that it passed, the fact that the governor vetoed it, the fact that lawmakers easily overrode that veto, what does that say about politics in Kentucky and what's concerning constituents these days?
The Louisville Courier-Journal covered some of a series of bills that were seen as targeting Louisville under the headline War on Louisville, but I would say it's even broader than that. It's really more of a war on American urban life, or maybe a war on California. What the legislatures are tackling, is the series of controversies and crises that were making the national news, a lot of it coming out of, the Bay Area, where you had much larger homeless encampments. It feels like an attempt to stop Kentucky from becoming California.
We're talking about Kentucky's recent legislative session, what passed, what didn't, and what to expect in the months ahead. Do you have questions about what happened during the session? You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. And the budget bill was the big priority this session. What do you see as the big wins for the state's Republican leaders in the budget bill?
I think that, again, they have such a large majority within the legislature that you saw a number of Republican priorities that were able to be funded through this. And I think being able to perhaps tout some support for education, but without actually implementing those pay raises, helped to diffuse some of the criticism perhaps surrounding the Republicans in the legislature.
And Sylvia, I know Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, who's a Democrat, was pushing for budget priorities related to public education that didn't make it in the form he suggested in the state budget. Talk about those and what Republican lawmakers decided to do instead.
Sure. So, initially, and Beshear's been calling this, I think, since he got into the governor's mansion. He's been calling for universal pre-K, universal teacher raises, and all school personnel more recently, fully funding the school transportation budget after we've had some pretty significant issues here in Louisville getting kids to school on time or even at all. Essentially, there's really been no appetite in the Republican legislature for those first two things, for universal teacher raises or to fund universal pre-K. I think the main argument that's been made that I've heard against universal teacher raises is that we have this thing called the SEEK formula in place. It is supposed to evenly distribute, equitably distribute funds to all the school districts across the state, make sure that it doesn't go too heavily to one or another. And those universal teacher raises would mess with that formula, that it would ruin that formula that is constitutionally mandated here in our state. Essentially, what they did instead is they put more money into the SEEK formula. They put more funds in there, and they said that should be enough to give some raises depending on what district you're in. There's definitely been some complaints from superintendents that it's not really enough to do any significant raises. I think the estimate has been between 2 and 5% possible in some districts, or maybe even less. That's kind of how they've navigated increasing funding on education instead of going Beshear's route of more, huge influxes of money.
And that SEEK formula, of course, is an outgrowth of the Kentucky Education Reform Act that was a result of a lawsuit back in 1990. That Reform Act, rather, was passed in 1990 that was a result of a lawsuit. So there's a lot of history there. Stephen, another big win for Republican lawmakers was passage of a bill that will put public funding for private schools on the ballot in November. So tell us what the fight was over and what exactly is going to be on the ballot.
The proposed amendment will authorize the use of public money to follow students based on the choice of parents to schools that are not conventional public schools. So on the one hand, you've got opposition to that amendment from folks who believe that public money should only go strictly to the public school system, that drawing money to these private schools that parents may choose for their children could lessen the resources available for public schools, could result in public schools being stuck with the hardest to teach, the most expensive students. The flip side is you have more conservative education reformers arguing that public schools, if they have a monopoly on public funds, they don't have to compete. They don't serve the needs of students and parents as well. If money follows the student, then both these private entities and the public schools will have reasons to serve those students better. That's the sort of theoretical argument. The problem with making that theoretical argument more practical is that until you have actual legislation that would put the constitutional amendment into play, you can sort of guess what's going to happen. And that allows both opponents and supporters of this change to view what would be likely to happen in the best light for their side.
And, alternatively and the worst light for the opposing side. And do you have thoughts on the implications of this amendment if it passes or fails? Is this something you've been watching?
It is. It's something that I've been following along with pretty closely. I know there have been several previous attempts in the Kentucky legislature to move forward with an option that would allow for the funding of charter schools or the creation of charter schools that have been tied up in court. And so this is another way to come around, I think, for the Republican legislature in an attempt to perhaps move forward with these charter spending bills that would kind of sidestep the need for those long protracted court hearings that we've been seeing filter through for the last 2 years or so. I think it's also representative of the fact that perhaps, although there is support amongst a segment of the electorate for the charter school funding, on the other hand, a lot of rural lawmakers may have a high percentage of school employees within their district who are voting. And as a result of that, perhaps have not been as willing to strike out as strongly in support of the charter schools. And this is a way to kick it back to voters so that they can argue, hey, we're doing something to try and implement this, but without actually having to, you know, really work through the bill on their own or really try to implement it forcefully for themselves.
Interesting. Stephen, did you want to add to that?
Well, you mentioned the Rose v. Council lawsuit that led to the Kentucky Education Reform Act. I just thought it would be helpful for listeners to understand that, unlike in many states, Kentucky has specific provisions in the Constitution that seem to foreclose something like charter schools, something like having voucher money flow to private institutions. That's why we're seeing this constitutional amendment. It's because the Kentucky Constitution is relatively specific against this sort of reform. A lot of states aren't.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I appreciate your adding that. Sylvia, let's talk also about this omnibus bill that I believe you mentioned earlier. It passed just about at the very end of the session. Explain what that is and what it will do.
Sure. So it's an attempt to improve maternal health and infant health in the state. There have been a few attempts in the past couple of sessions to do that, usually with more money than this one has. This one isn't a huge spending bill. Mostly what it does is it allows pregnant women makes pregnancy a qualifying life event for insurance. So, you know, it expands insurance options for pregnant people. That's one of the main things it does. It also creates a mortality, infant and maternal mortality review board, kind of to review all of the cases and collect more data so we can understand the issue in our state better. And that's just a couple of the things it does. It does a few other small things. You know, it increases telehealth options for providers to pregnant women, things like that. And essentially, the reason why the bill, there's a lot of reasons why the bill got held up, but one of the main reasons is that on top of that legislation, early on in the session was added these sort of anti-abortion elements to this otherwise extremely bipartisan bill, and it held it up. And at the last minute, those were stripped off. The bill, the omnibus, was added as a piggyback to a different bill through some legislative finagling, and essentially it passed clean versions of both bills without these anti-abortion riders. Hmm.
And how big a deal is this legislation? What kind of difference will this make for Kentucky moms and babies?
Kentucky does have a very high rate of maternal mortality. And so I think anything that can be done to help provide services for pregnant persons and for infants would be a welcome addition, which is why I think you see such wide bipartisan support, really, other than those riders that Sylvia had mentioned, and why you saw so much support and efforts to get it promoted at the very end to make sure that the opportunity did not close before that bill was passed. Mm-hmm.
Stephen, you mentioned the relationship between Kentucky Democrats and Republicans a little bit earlier, and there were a few bills introduced by Democrats that passed this session. One was related to helping crime victims. There was another related to solving cold cases, expanding a crime victim compensation program, and another related to finding missing adults. How difficult is it for Democrats to get legislation passed with Kentucky's supermajority in the legislature?
Usually for a Democrat to get a piece of legislation through such a heavily Republican General Assembly requires the legislator either to have built some really nice, strong relationships with folks on the other side, or to move forward bills that are basically unobjectionable to the other party. What makes it especially difficult for Democrats in the Kentucky case is that our sessions are so short, and there's so many bills that are maybe good bills that just aren't going to come up for consideration because of the time pressures, that Republican leaders have little incentive to play ball with Democrats who want to pass even bills that they'd find fine if they had more time.
And do you think the party divisions are as deep in Kentucky as they are on the national level?
I do think that's the case. I think we're seeing this polarization widespread across the nation. And you definitely saw some bills that maybe didn't pass in the end, but some of the anti-DEI legislation that was promoted in the state, I think, is in direct response to sort of trends at the national level, a national level discussion, the types of bills that may be passing in some other states. And so I definitely think you see that polarization as well taking effect in Kentucky, although with such large majorities in both the House and Senate in Kentucky, it is difficult, as Stephen had mentioned, for Democrats to really perhaps exercise their voice or to have much hope at getting their bills passed.
Well, we're going to continue our conversation, and up next, we'll discuss what didn't pass this session. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our regional politics show with a focus on Kentucky. My guests are Eastern Kentucky University Government Professor Ann Sismar, University of Kentucky Associate Professor of Political Science Stephen Voss, and Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We did get an email from a listener whose politics will become pretty clear as I read this to you. The listener says the only reason Republicans have a supermajority is because of extreme gerrymandering. Let Kentuckians vote in fair elections. They vote for sensible, caring individuals like Andy Beshear. So I think that's a Governor Beshear supporter there. But Stephen, what role does do district lines play in the Kentucky supermajority in the legislature?
Well, for sure, Republicans drew the current maps to improve the circumstances for their party. So, you know, they picked up a couple of House seats and a Senate seat as a result of changing lines that used to be more favorable to Democrats in their direction. On the other hand, you know, I was part of the litigation that tried to throw out the state house districts. I did work for the Republican side, I should stress. But even the Democratic experts that were brought in from MIT and from Harvard, they weren't claiming that getting rid of the partisan gerrymandering would have caused the Republicans to lose their supermajority. We're talking about maybe a half a dozen seats difference here at the most. Even without the gerrymandering that was criticized, the Republicans were still running the show.
Anne, anything you want to add to that?
I would concur with what Stephen was saying related to the level of increase in Republican identification within the state indicates that the state really is trending red. And so even if you have certain districts that maybe are packed or gerrymandered, you still have an overall rightward shift or movement within the state, as you see from a number of different elections. Of course, Andy Beshear is being sort of the outlier in this.
Yeah. Sylvia, now let's talk about some of the controversial measures that didn't pass this session. What were the DEI bills that were being considered by lawmakers?
Sure. So we had three DEI bills, two that were priorities, one in the House, one in the Senate. The House version was I generally considered more extreme. It would have banned DEI initiatives and offices and officers at all public universities, versus the one in the Senate would have largely dealt with these diversity statements that some colleges require of, you know, on applications for faculty positions or potentially in applications, you know, making a statement about how your work contributes to diversity efforts, things like that, or any other sort of potentially, you know, politically motivated statement would not be allowed under the Senate version of the bill. And, you know, in the early days, in the first, you know, month or two of the session, it was the Senate bill that went forward, the more mild one that moved on in the process, and it passed the Senate and it moved on to the House. And in the House, it got packed almost entirely with the House language. It was a little bit different from that first House version, but in essence, it was that exact same bill banning DEI initiatives at public colleges. And it seemed, at least, and it appears, you know, based on this final product of the bill not getting passed, that was done without the permission or the support of its Senate leaders. And so when it got back to the Senate, it seemed that there was disagreement about that language. There were some concerns, you know, based on things that Senate leadership have said about constitutionality. They haven't been more specific than that about what specific constitutional concerns. But essentially, the bill died before it could pass. It could gain concurrence from the Senate.
Stephen, I know some university presidents made statements opposing this legislation. What, if any, impact do you think that had on this debate?
You know, I think that even Kentucky's Republicans are relatively supportive of education compared to what we're seeing in a lot of, for example, Deep South states. I think multiple times over the last few years, we've seen cases where university presidents got involved and some Republicans worked with the Democrats to either scale back the the sort of more extreme version of the legislation that was originally proposed, or even to kill bills. I mean, I wasn't on the inside of that, you know, university lobbying effort, but it does seem like we have a trend over the last few years of the university successfully beating back legislation that's scary to people who work in the industry at first.
And what do you think about that? And was this a win for Democrats?
I'm not sure. I guess what I would say is that we'll know in the next legislative session about whether or not Democrats really had success in this, or whether it was simply a case in which they couldn't agree upon the level of extremism, let's say, in the DEI bill. And so my suspicion is that this is actually going to come back through in the next legislative session again in some type of form or flavor. And so I think that will actually give us an indication about whether this is a win for Democrats or just a time in which they weren't able to iron out the details before they ran out of time.
Yeah. Whether it's a win for Democrats or whether Republicans just couldn't decide where they wanted to land on the whole thing.
Yeah. Right.
Sylvia, excuse me, there was also a bill that proposed cutting SNAP and that the benefit formerly known as food stamps, and one that would have loosened child labor laws. Tell us about those bills.
Sure. So I reported most heavily on the loosening of child labor laws. That bill and both of those bills actually failed in committee before they could get voted on in the Senate, which is actually extremely rare for a Republican bill to fail in a Republican committee. Usually, if they don't think they have the votes for it, they just don't vote on it in that committee hearing. But both of them failed. The child labor bill, essentially, it would have taken Kentucky to the federal baseline. So obviously, we have a federal child labor laws that apply to all states. That was passed, you know, 100 years ago, a little less than 100 years ago, but a long time ago. And states are allowed to add their own on top. And Kentucky has several child labor laws. And essentially what this would mostly change is the child labor laws for 16 and 17 year olds. The bill in its original form, at least, would have allowed children to work through the night, for example. It would have allowed 16 and 17 year olds to not have like a 40-hour work week restriction, things like that. And the argument in favor was that, you know, children, if they want to work, they should be able to, and we shouldn't be restricting them, creating work ethic, things like that. But there was significant concerns within the Republican Party, I think, and also from labor unions, which still have some power in the legislature lobbying-wise. And essentially, it failed in committee the first time. And then it passed on a second attempt, but it never got voted on the Senate floor. And so it died. And I think that there were some significant concerns that it would, you know, hurt children's academic careers, things like that, you know, in this time when I think, like Stephen Voss was saying, that there is an effort to improve Kentucky's higher education. We definitely, you know, we have many leaders who are pro higher education. They're trying to get more kids into higher ed. And so there is a concern that that could hurt those efforts.
And what do you think? Do you think the arguments related to education were a big factor in these? I don't know whether what you think these bills, the failure of these bills, says about our legislature, if it says anything.
I do think that this is part of that moderating element, though, even in the polarized era that we've been talking about, related to some support for higher education, or just a sense that perhaps we should not be dialing back protections for children or families, thinking about the SNAP benefits, thinking about protections for child labor. And so I do think that it is part of that moderating story where we're maybe not as extreme as some other states.
And there was also a push to pass exceptions for Kentucky's strict abortion ban. Those didn't get very far this session either. Talk with us about what was proposed and what happened with those.
So there are a couple of different efforts to help and perhaps dial back some of the very strong regulations against abortion, an attempt with the Hadley's Law to have protections for cases of rape, incest, or danger to the woman's life, in addition to these protections that would perhaps allow for more access to abortion in these cases, like in the Hadley case. And so we saw that those were floated, but didn't really go anywhere. And I know I think Republican legislators kind of indicated, well, there wasn't really a lot of interest or a lot of emphasis put on those. It wasn't really requested that they be moved forward to committee and really discussed. But I do think it's telling that those bills didn't really go much of anywhere.
And Sylvia, remind us of who Hadley is.
Sure. So Hadley kind of came, Hadley Duvall is her full name, but she came into the spotlight during Governor Beshear's re-election campaign. Actually, she was featured in one of his ads in this context of exceptions for abortion. She is a survivor of childhood sexual abuse at the hands of her stepfather, and she did become pregnant. She, had a miscarriage before she, had to consider an abortion, but she's become a very strong advocate for women's rights, for exceptions to the abortion ban, if not, removing the abortion ban in totality. And so she was involved with Senator David Yates, who proposed Hadley's law. And it was named after her, and in honor of her story, that these exceptions be made not just for adult women, but for children as well.
Stephen, how big an issue is abortion for Kentucky voters?
It matters, and the politics of abortion has flipped from being something that helped the Republican Party electorally to something that has been helping Democrats lately. In particular, I analyzed Governor Beshear's re-election vote. We usually focus on what changes in an election rather than what's the same. For the most part, Andy Beshear did well in 2023 in the same places he did well 4 years earlier. But what really stood out is that he overperformed his previous, election when he ran for re-election. He overperformed in the same places that defeated a constitutional amendment proposal that would have locked Kentucky's abortion ban into place. All signs are that the same places that were against locking anti-abortion regulations in the Constitution also gave Andy Beshear more support than he otherwise might have expected.
And you were just talking about kind of the big picture when it comes to the issue of abortion. What about the big picture when it comes to the child labor bill and the DEI bills? What's the broader legislative context there?
Yeah, what I think listeners need to keep in mind when they hear about these bills failing is what Ann said specifically about the DEI legislation, which is that often policy changes don't pass the first time. The first session when they're brought up, the proposers learn what the opposition is. They sort of feel out people who are on the fence to figure out how they can change the legislation to make it more acceptable. And often what you'll see is that the policy change only comes in the next session or the one after that. That's a common experience with legislation.
Do you think there's any chance that could be the experience that these bills related to exceptions to Kentucky's abortion ban could have, Stephen? I mean, why, with the what you just said about the role that abortion plays in the electorate, why do you think these proposals didn't gain more traction? Do you think they could come back?
Republicans are in a very tough place on abortion. It's been said they caught the tiger by the tail. Kentucky passed some fairly stringent regulations at a time when no one really thought they would take place, that they would take effect, because Roe v. Wade, the federal constitutional ruling, was blocking that trigger law from being triggered and going into effect. Now, Republicans would be in the position of scaling back something that activists on their side won, on pro-life, that pro-life activists that historically have been with the Republicans have won. That's a tough thing to do. But if they don't roll back some of those stringent regulations, they're paying an electoral cost.
Well, we are going to continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our regional politics show, and we're focusing on Kentucky this month. My guests are Eastern Kentucky University Government Professor Ann Sismar, University of Kentucky Associate Professor of Political Science Stephen Boss, and Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. I have seen commentary that one of the big things that's united Republicans in Kentucky is their opposition to Democratic Governor Andy Beshear. And what do you think about that?
I'm sure that's the case. So whenever you have somebody who is able to be successful from the other party and is kind of an outlier in this regard, then you would think that there's going to be a lot of effort to sort of fight back, right, of from the other party's successes. He is kind of a unique governor and popular, even though the state's trending more Republican. He's been able to stay with it and win. And so I think it is true that they have this sort of united front, perhaps against Bashir's popularity.
Stephen, what do you think about that? And that seems to have been a driving force in some legislative changes, too, in terms of kind of reining in the power that the governor has.
Right, Lisa. That's actually what I wanted to add is, yes, this is a battle between a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature. But because we have this Democrat as governor, it means that the legislative branch is more jealous of its power, more jealous of its prerogatives. And they've passed legislation that, you know, even after Governor Bashir's gone, will have tilted the balance of power, but, you know, toward the legislative branch and away from the executive branch. So we'll be experiencing the influence of that feud later on.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's any way it could kind of tilt back the other way if there's a governor that the legislators like better?
You know, even when we've had both a legislative branch and a governor of the same party, we've seen conflict between them. Wallace Wilkinson, for example, feuded when he was a Democrat, feuded with the Democratic General Assembly that he faced. So no, you know, even if you get a Republican governor, you might find the legislators wanting to hold on to the new influence, the new power they've had. It would take a remarkable circumstance for a governor to say, hey, why don't y'all shift power back to me? And the legislative branch say, sure, sure thing.
Yeah, they'd have to be super tight for that to happen, I guess. And the legislature overrode most, but not all of Governor Bashir's vetoes. What did that tell you?
I'm trying to remember which ones were the ones he was able to sustain. But again, we have the supermajority in the Kentucky legislature. And so a lot of times I think the vetoes that are issued by Bashir are to demonstrate his priorities, Democratic priorities, to provide that leadership on the other side, even if there are times in which he knows that he's going to be overridden.
Yeah. Sylvia, can you remind us which ones were sustained? As I recall, several of them were almost kind of technical in nature.
Yeah, you know, I could be wrong here. I thought there was only one bill that Bashir vetoed in its entirety. You know, not including line item vetoes that the legislature chose not to override, and that was House Bill 771, which was not a controversial bill. It had to do with spendthrift trusts. That I won't go into that too much, but I did read a lot about spendthrift trusts. And essentially, it seemed like it was over an issue with the wording of the bill. It would delete more of statute than it needed to, something along those lines. So that veto stood. There was also, one line item veto, I believe, that stood that in the budget bill. There's also another stranger one that I'm not sure exactly if we know the conclusion of that, but Bashir also did line item vetoes on the revenue bill and the legislature just said that they don't have to override that the governor does not get to issue line item vetoes on a revenue bill, only on spending bills. So they just chose not to override it and ignored the override entirely and said that the bill is now in law anyways. So not exactly sure where we landed on that. The governor's office said that they believe they did have the right to line item veto that. I'm not sure if we'll see a court challenge on that or how that's going to play out.
Yeah. Stephen, what do you think about all these overrides?
Yeah, one thing that an Ohio-based audience might need to hear is that in Kentucky, it only takes a majority of each chamber to override a gubernatorial veto. We're one of a handful of states that have the threshold that low. So, you know, when people outside the state hear about how often the Democratic governor is being steamrolled on these veto overrides, that's something to take into account. Is it only takes a majority. It doesn't even require this so-called supermajority to beat him.
With the supermajority the Republicans have, though, are the votes even close?
Yeah, you can't just look at the vote count and assume that that's the way it would look if a supermajority had been required. You know, if you're on the Republican side and it's obvious the Democratic governor is going to lose, voting with him anyway, and therefore breaking party unity, just doesn't seem to be worth the percentage, you know. But if there were an actual chance to uphold a veto of legislation you didn't like, then some of those Republican votes might well have gone a different direction.
I see. Sylvia, Governor Beshear's opponent in the last gubernatorial race, former Attorney General Daniel Cameron, has formed a PAC. What do we know about why?
Oh, you know, I would have to look at that again to see why exactly he's forming his PAC. You know, Governor Beshear formed his own PAC. I think it was late last year. So it just kind of shows that more interest in getting involved in national politics, being a national political figure. Beshear announced the first round of his spending from that PAC, and it was a lot of people outside of Kentucky. I think there's only one person from Kentucky in that, and that was a Kentucky Supreme Court justice race. So I think it's kind of part of Kentucky figures, including Daniel Cameron, Governor Beshear, playing a part in national politics and becoming a leader within the party nationally.
Mm-hmm. And what's your take? Do you have thoughts or Stephen on why, former Attorney General Daniel Cameron might want to kind of elevate his national profile? I guess I wonder if he's positioning himself for a future U.S. Senate race.
I was thinking exactly the same thing. So it's still kind of early to know, but you know, we do have that Senate seat coming up in 2026, right, that Mitch McConnell is in. And so I'm wondering whether or not he may be pivoting or looking towards that race already. Additionally, you know, we know with term limits, Andy Beshear can't run again for this current seat. And so I expect that Republicans are already going to start lining up to think about challenging for that governor's race, even though it's long in the distance, because it's likely to go to a Republican the next time around.
Yeah. Stephen, and former Attorney General Daniel Cameron has a very close relationship with Senator Mitch McConnell, doesn't he?
He was seen for some time as the likely heir apparent for Mitch McConnell's seat. You know, the conventional wisdom now is that Cameron's running for U.S. Senate for that seat, that Andy Barr, Central Kentucky's representative, is maybe going to run for that seat, that Thomas Massey in Northern Kentucky might be eyeing that seat. But the problem with believing that sort of conventional wisdom is precisely what I just said a second ago. The conventional wisdom was that Cameron was supposed to be a senator, and he ended up running for governor, surprising a lot of people. We often don't know what these folks are really up to unless we're one of the insiders, you know, who know them personally.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, Sylvia was just talking about this PAC that Governor Beshear has formed that seems to be kind of raising his profile a little bit, too. What do you make of that? What do you think is going on with Governor Beshear's PAC?
Unlike Daniel Cameron's, which my recollection is he said was specifically for Kentucky Republicans, Beshear was looking at the national stage. You know, his money was supposed to help the sort of common sense Democrats who could win in red states, you know, who could win in areas where Democrats normally lose. Now, trying to figure out why he wanted that national profile, though, may be a question without an answer, because he didn't really need only one reason. Did it set up for a possible presidential run? Sure, that kind of PAC could do that. But it also could set him up for other sorts of, you know, national jobs, appointments of the like. I don't think Beshear needed one goal in setting up that sort of national PAC.
What do you think, Anne? What do you think the future might hold for Governor Beshear? He certainly has several more years left during his term as governor. But when he won the governor's race again in such a red state, a lot of people started talking about him.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot about him that might make him a successful candidate looking to the national stage for a number of different potential offices or appointments, as Stephen had mentioned. And so I don't even know that the candidates themselves always know exactly what that next step is going to be, because I think they do respond in real time to what other competitors are doing and the status of what's happening in politics at that moment when they're making their decisions. But I know that he's probably looking then at what is going to be his next step after he leaves the governor's mansion. It's years in the distance. I know he has a lot to accomplish still in the Commonwealth of Kentucky over that time, but he's definitely looking forward to what is going to be the next position after this one.
Sylvia, has the governor dropped any hints or made any kind of statements about what the future might hold during news conferences or when you've been able to catch him in the hall?
I would say he's very actively not dropped any hints. You know, anytime you ask him anything about it, he mostly just says, you know, I'm focused on being the governor. You know, like Ann was saying, he has a long future ahead of him. He's a relatively young governor, a young guy. There's a lot of room for future political aspirations, but he stayed very adamant that he's focused in on Kentucky. The one thing I will note is I have noticed him commenting more on national politics than he did in his first 4 years as governor. That might be because he's not running, he can't run for governor again. And, you know, obviously Trump is popular in Kentucky and Biden is not. So speaking out against something Trump said was more politically dangerous before, but he has been a little bit more outspoken about national politics. Obviously, the PAC is a clear example of that. But even just, you know, condemning a statement that Trump has made or something like that, he's done more of that recently, you know, from my vantage point. But I would say he's very adamantly not commented on what's ahead of him. So it really is all speculation.
Interesting. Stephen, we talked about how the Republican-dominated legislature has really done a lot to curtail the governor's power and take more of that power back for state lawmakers. Do you think we'll see more of that in the years and sessions ahead?
We may see more. You know, they started slowly. They mostly were grabbing back or clawing back emergency powers that the governor had, you know, during that long period of time when the legislature was out of session. But more recent legislation is more permanent and broader, such as trying to control who gets final say on who runs Kentucky's education department, for example. The big one that I think should interest people outside of the state is they've taken away the governor's power, or tried to at least, to decide who gets to replace a senator. If a senator leaves in midterm, you know, the sort of obvious goal here is that if, for whatever reason, Mitch McConnell needs to step down or otherwise cannot finish out his term, the Republicans here did not want a Democratic governor picking the replacement.
Yeah. And the governor's kind of promised that he might, he's kind of alluded that he might challenge that in court, I believe, hasn't he?
There were hints that at least the one that forced him to pick from a list provided to him, mm-hmm. From the Republicans, he might have challenged. Now, though, the legislation that moved forward is a little cleaner and a little more common, which is to say just the governor's power to replace the senator was taken away.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Eastern Kentucky University Government Professor Ann Sismar, University of Kentucky Associate Professor of Political Science Stephen Voss, and Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Reporter Sylvia Goodman. Thank you all so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.